And welcome to another installment of Mercenary Musings Radio, an exclusive audio service presenting views and insight from the mercenary geologist himself, Mickey Fulp. Mickey, how have you been?
I've been well, Rob. Did some traveling last week, was in Chicago for a show, and got a White Sox game and did a little fishing, and now I'm back in New Mexico, and it's almost like the clone days here this time of year. It's 7 degrees at night, 25 in the day, sunny, not a breath of wind, and just gorgeous here.
Well, boy, baseball and sunshine, you're living the life, aren't you? Good stuff. We're going to talk nickel for this edition of the program. Mickey, it's a metal that has really seen a bumpy price ride of late. It's down sharply from where it was a year ago. We'll discuss the reasons for that a little bit later. First, let's talk about the characteristics of nickel. Mickey, what can you tell us?
Well, we're working our way through the so-called ferrous alloy metals, the ferrous metals, so it's one of those. It's a transition metal, number 28 on the periodic chart, kind of a silver, gold, white metal, very hard, takes polish, ductile. It's corrosion resistant because it forms a very thin oxide coating, high melting point. And it occurs as a natural alloy on the Earth and also in meteorites and especially in the Earth's core.
Okay. Tell us about when it was first discovered. Last show out, we were talking about a ferrous metal that had been first discovered in China. Where does China fit into the realm here for nickel?
Well, I'm not really sure about China, but I do know that it was used as its native alloy, iron nickel alloy, with meteorites as early as 3500 BC. But it was really not discovered and isolated as element till about 1751. In fact, the Germans called it the devil's copper, Kupfernickel, because it was a contaminant for copper ore, and they couldn't separate it.
You mentioned meteorites. You know, I'm located here in Toronto, just a few hundred miles from one of the hot spots in the world for nickel, the Sudbury Basin. And that's a basin because, I guess, a long time ago, that's where a meteorite struck.
Yeah, it's a big meteor impact crater that basically plumbed the mantle and produced some of the world's giant nickel copper deposits.
Okay, what about some of its early uses? How was it used way back when? And bring us up to date on some of the more widespread uses and demand for nickel today.
Well, it really wasn't used way back when, and it basically became used when major deposits were discovered. For instance, at Sudbury, I think when the Canadian Pacific Railroad was put there, or one of your railroads anyway, and Norilsk, a very famous place in Russia. But it's used as alloys. 60% of nickel is used in stainless steel, and you add in other specialty and super alloys, and you're looking at another 37%. And less than 3% would be used in chemicals and catalysts. It's essentially, as goes the steel industry, so goes the nickel business.
Okay, and the main benefit is what? It's really adding strength. It's good for preventing corrosion. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's stainless steel, so yeah, strength and corrosion, and as much the same as uses as in a certain degree as the element we talked about last time out, which was chromium. And in fact, chromium can be a substitute for nickel in stainless steel, and that especially happens when prices for nickel are high, and the prices of nickel is very volatile.
And how much nickel in a nickel? You know, those 5 cent coins that we use. Now, understand, fact, there's very little.
I don't think Canadians have any nickel in their nickels anymore, but the U.S. certainly does. And a nickel has had 25% nickel and 75% copper in it since sometime in the 1850s. It's become, with the price of nickel, very volatile. Quite often, the amount of metal in a U.S. nickel exceeds the value of 5 cents. So it didn't take the U.S. very long in 2006 to make it a crime to melt nickels down for their metal content or to export them. And you can now face a fine of $10,000 and 5 years in prison. But that, does, of course, does not stop some people from hoarding nickels.
Yeah. Why even have nickel in a nickel, though, if it's worth more than a nickel? That's a question,
yeah.
Isn't it? You know, a question that I guess that you and I really can't answer right now. Another little tidbit of information, Nikki. Did you know that earrings today are made nickel-free because of, I guess, you know, nickel comes into contact with skin. It can cause an allergy and a lot of itching and stuff.
And it can cause an allergy, and certain people are susceptible. So it has historically been used in jewelry as a metal alloy, but now you can actually get nickel-free jewelry. Because of that.
Okay, now we did mention that Sudbury, Ontario, certainly one of the major nickel-producing regions in the world, the main nickel-producing countries, Canada, Russia, Australia, I believe. What is your current read on market supply and demand right now, Mickey? We alluded to the price movement. It's certainly been anything but smooth sailing for nickel. What does that reflect in terms of market demand and supply?
Nickel's very much tied to the world economy and the steel industry, so the ups and downs and the volatility in the nickel price really does not have that much to do with supply, but it does have a lot to do with demand as per the steel industry. As you mentioned, Russia is a big producer, but the Philippines and Indonesia have now passed Canada and Australia, and that has a lot to do with the fact that in a sense, we have found and maximized our production of sulfide deposits worldwide. So more and more we are going to these laterite deposits, which occur in the tropics and essentially are residual deposits from weathering in tropical soils. So that has become the next big thing in the nickel business, and so you see places like the Philippines, Madagascar, Brazil, Indonesia, New Caledonia, which in actuality were the first big nickel deposits discovered in the late 1800s. And so these nickel laterite deposits are becoming more and more prevalent and exploited. However, they are very energy intensive because of the metallurgical process to get the nickel out. So it's a mixed bag there, because with high oil prices, some of these nickel laterite deposits quickly become uneconomic.
Right.
And in my tenure as a field geologist, economic geologist, I've seen many nickel laterite mines come and go over the years. So it's both a blessing and a curse, the fact that although we're running out of sulfide deposits, we do have the laterite ores, but they are not particularly economic at times.
Okay, we are in the middle of earnings season, as you know, Mickey, and you alluded to the rising, you know, the high cost of production for some of these companies. I know a number of producers that have come out with their latest quarterly results, certainly detailing sharply lower profits. How are you viewing this segment of the mining industry today from an investing point of view?
Well, if you want to invest in the nickel business, you got to play the big miners. So in terms of producers, we have the giant Russian nickel copper producer and platinum group metals, Norilsk, which just happens to own Stillwater, which is one of the few places in the U.S. that any nickel production comes out of. Vale, BHP Billiton, Xstrata, and then we have some other ones. There's an Indonesian company, Aneco, Tambang. We've got Aramet, which is a French company. We've got a Chinese company in there. So this is big major miners. The price volatility precludes really knowing exactly how these miners are going to perform on the nickel end, but these are integrated mining companies, so they're not pure nickel plays. You know, the price of nickel over the last 5 years has gone as high as $24 a pound and as low as say $5.50 a pound. It's currently about $8.
Right.
So this is very volatile. And it's not really a game that juniors should play. They try, but in my opinion, they don't have much success. doing that. You know, we've got some juniors that are involved in the U.S. With the Duluth Gabbro, which has been around for something on the order of 40, 55 years since it was discovered, and it still is too low grade and too metallurgically difficult to process. We've got four juniors in that realm. We've got the Marathon Complex in near Thunder Bay, Ontario, same sort of deposit, and has never been successfully developed. In the James Bay Lowlands, there was a nickel discovery and a new mine put in, which has since failed. And then we have some of these low-grade metallic nickel deposits in central and northern BC, but they again are very low-grade, and the metallurgical process has not been proven. So that's a bit of a crapshoot, too. So personally, I would not tread in nickel space with the junior resource sector.
Okay, we'll wrap it up on that note, Mickey. And, of course, we will be back in a couple of weeks. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I think it's probably about time that we revert back to our roots here, Rob, and take a look at copper and maybe gold and review where those major metals that really drive a lot of our sector, how they've been looking the last few months. And then after we do that, I think we'll go into perhaps the alkali metals and discuss those for a few shows.
Okay, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Copper and gold on the menu. Thanks very much for this, Mickey.
All right, thank you, Rob.
Okay, that is Mickey Fult, the Mercenary Geologist. You can find him on the web at mercenarygeologist.com. I'm Robert Graham at Mercenary Musings Radio. Thanks for listening.